We turn our focus now to the world's largest continent, Asia. So we give to Jeff Gaynor the task of being our absolute speediest track star in covering the kilometers. Jeff's had a lot of experience in Asia. He made his first visit to Southeast Asia in 1969 as the guest of the United States Army. After leaving the Army, he has returned every year for one reason or another, primarily for political research, to that continent. He just returned, in fact, a few weeks ago from a fairly extensive trip through East Asia. In recent years, he has, I think you are the senior person on board at the Heritage Foundation. You have been with the foundation. Yes, right. Let's say consistent longevity. He's been at the Heritage. He's been at the Heritage Foundation longer than anybody else at that organization. He was previously the director of foreign and defense policy studies at Heritage. He is today at the Heritage Foundation the counselor for international affairs, known affectionately to all throughout the Heritage by the initials of his office, the CIA. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Gaynor.
I'm pleased to be back here this year. Last year I was able to talk at the same forum about the situation in Africa. I managed to come out of Africa and given that to Jay, and I've moved instead from the continent which has the most unfree countries in the world to the continent which has the most unfree people in the world. In deciding what to focus on there, I thought I would follow up on my most recent CIA visit to East Asia and touch upon primarily the countries I visited, which are the ones that have the most interesting situation for the future of freedom, I think, in East Asia, namely in Korea, in China, and Indonesia. First, I thought I'd make a general comment about the state of freedom in the world, one of the only things I think Dr. Blaustein did not touch on, and it would be that the Reagan administration is coming into a lot of criticism for supposedly abandoning human rights compared to the Carter administration, but what was intriguing to me this year when the Freedom House survey came out, which has just been alluded to a moment ago, is that of the, I think, 17 years they've been conducting this survey of freedom, the issue that came out this year indicated that the higher percentage of people of the world are living in freedom now than in any year since the survey started. So I'm not sure if there's a direct connection to what the Reagan administration's been doing, and I have some criticism for what they've done in certain areas, but overall, I think it's been generally positive. And in specific areas, of course, I think the transition to a freer society has been much better managed under the Reagan administration in terms of what's happened, at least so far, in Haiti and the Philippines, say, than has what happened under the Carter administration in Iran and Nicaragua. So I might just start with the Philippines situation, which over the last year has had probably the greatest deal of attention. The verdict is still significantly out on the Philippines, I think, as the politics of Marcos has now turned to the politics of Cory Aquino, and there's some fear in the Philippines, and legitimate so far, that the cronyism of Marcosism is now being somewhat replaced by a Cory cronyism, so to speak, and it remains to be seen in terms of the upcoming elections there whether you will have a completely free and unfettered election or whether the people who had been displaced by Marcos, in effect, have staked out their own claims on offices there and will not be forced out of them through free elections. The more serious threat to the Philippines, though, at the moment, of course, comes from the New People's Army, the communist-oriented revolutionary movement trying to topple the government there, as it had been trying to with Marcos. Many of us were told for so many years that this movement was simply reflected discontent with undemocratic actions of Ferdinand Marcos. But with Marcos passing from the scene, ironically, the threat posed by the New People's Army has grown rather than diminished. And even Cory Aquino, I think, is finally at her wit's ends in dealing with them and has talked of destroying them militarily now, which I think is probably the only effective way to deal with this particular movement. The other intriguing area to me in Southeast Asia now is Indonesia, which hasn't been in the news very much lately, but they're going to move to elections there in the next several weeks, in fact, but they are elections in which there is no doubt the government party will come back into power. But nonetheless, there has been incremental movement, I would contend, there to a broadening of the democratic system and even also of the economic system. Unfortunately, in Indonesia, with the oil gusher booming years ago, enormous amounts of money were squandered in state-run projects, as well as a lot of it was lost in terms of corruption. But with the price of oil falling, there's actually been some constraints now within the government in Indonesia, and even some inching towards privatization and movements towards economic freedom there, mostly because they're being compelled to do this by economic necessity. The two threats that really are posed to the Indonesian government come, as in the Philippines, from a potential communist movement there. As you know, in 1965, they narrowly averted the communist takeover with Sukarno. And the other threat, which is maybe the growing one and maybe even more serious, is the threat of fundamental Muslim faith intruding itself into politics. Fortunately, the government party there has, in fact, compelled the other parties that are running in the elections there to embrace the general secular program of the existing government, the Golkar Party, as it's called, so that they all must avoid, essentially, the intrusion of Islamic fundamentalism into politics there. So they've effectively done this also by taking many Islamic leaders and putting them into the government party and are running for office. So I think the government party will stay in power there probably with a broader consensus of support than they maybe even had before. So their main problem, I think, is one of economics now and of broadening the political base of support based upon economic progress. The situation in China is a bit different and complicated, of course. We were told so much of the tremendous progress being made in China, as somebody had dubbed it. We moved maybe from the so-called enlightened neo-Leninist regime of Deng Xiaoping to possibly return to orthodox neo-Maoism with the present ruling majority in the Politburo there, and possibly a bit of a replay of the Cultural Revolution in China. But I think the demise of freedom in China is greatly exaggerated because it never existed there in the first place. I would note when I was there a couple years ago and talked relatively freely with several students and people who had recently graduated from school that several of them told me their principal objective in life was to get out of the country because they never really had any hopes it would develop into a completely free and democratic society. Another intriguing thing I was told by a young fellow who'd recently graduated from college, he was assigned to teach school in one of the provinces, and he told me that he didn't want to take that job. He wanted to stay and continue to live and work in Shanghai, where he was from. And since he didn't accept the government job, he was told he could apply for no job for the next year. And fortunately, he could continue to live with his parents, and so he did this. But one of the other things they first did was they took away his library card. Going to the library in China is a privilege. It is not a right. And so he was left to fend for himself for the next year before he could apply for another job. And this was under the more enlightened Deng Xiaoping period as opposed to the one we're moving into now. But there is a dynamic that is a little bit uncontrollable in China by virtue of the amount the system has opened up to foreigners coming there, as well as the fact that they've sent over 10,000 students to the United States for education, most of which many of which are starting to return. It remains questionable whether most of them will return, given the situation there. And in fact, over 1,000 of them signed a letter protesting the recent actions of the Communist Party of China clamping down on the students. While on the other hand, you have this demise, if you want, of freedom before it even got started in the People's Republic of China, there's continued to be an appropriate growth of freedom in Free China, or the Republic of China in Taiwan. There they've always had the most widely shared, if you want, economic freedom, in which the wealth of the country was most broadly shared amongst all the people. This is now being complemented by the growth of a multi-party system there, with the Kuomintang Party, which has ruled the country since they moved to Taiwan, is now being forced, if you want, by their own choice, to confront an opposition party officially. Before, there had been independent candidates running against the KMT, but they have now allowed them to form a political party in opposition. Fortunately, in the Republic of China, I think the situation is parallel somewhat to what I would call Japanese democracy, and maybe applies to Indonesia as well, although both Taiwan and Indonesia would not like allusions to a Japanese system as being parallel to their own. But you've had basically the government parties there have become so strong over the years and have such a broad and genuinely popular consensus that they could move to a thoroughly democratic system, and I think probably the rule in those countries is no more threatened than has been the case with the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan since it came to power. So this broadening of freedom in Taiwan, I think, is entirely encouraging development, and it is genuine in contrast sharply with what's happening in the People's Republic of China. The probably most disconcerting situation to me in my recent trip to Asia has to do with Korea, where it's appropriate to initially mention, and often isn't, as there are two elements of the Korean equation that should be always stated at the outset of any discussion of politics in South Korea, and that is the situation in North Korea. Appropriately, the human rights report that just came out by the State Department, Richard Schifter, the Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs, noted that in North Korea you had the closest thing to an Orwellian 1984-type society. We also have the interesting development there in which they're in competition, I suppose, with the Romanians government to see whether they may become the first communist regime to become a dynasty, whether Ceausescu passes his leadership on to his wife or whether Kim Il-sung passes leadership on to his son, Kim Sung-il. But in any case, the contrast remains extraordinarily sharp between North and South Korea, and complementing that contrast, the totalitarian situation is a security threat to South Korea. Nonetheless, I think once again through, I think, relatively effective role the United States has played in Korea, the South Korean government is moving, hopefully early next year, to the first transition from military rule to a democratically elected civilian government. The president of South Korea has already indicated his willingness to move in this direction. What he's called for is a parliamentary system of government to provide for the best kind of transition and to maintain the kind of consensus society in South Korea that thus far has done very well for them, both politically, militarily, in terms of their security. Unfortunately, the principal opposition in South Korea, as is the case with the North Korea, their names are Kim, so it's very easy for those of you who don't have a scorecard to keep track of who's who. The opposition to the North and to the South are all Kims. The dictator of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, and in South Korea the opposition is Kim Yong-sam and Kim Dae-jung. And the two Kims in the South, unfortunately, are calling for a presidential elections or no elections, because both of them want to be president. And aside from them battling each other out and destroying each other, the one thing they do hold in common is they want to be the president to succeed Chun Doo-hwan, so they are violently opposed, increasingly with demonstrations in the street, in fact, to moving to a parliamentary system instead of a presidential system. So the question there isn't the movement to democracy, but what kind of democracy? And I think that that's what one needs keeps in mind, because unfortunately the opposition has, if you want, degenerated into this position that they have to have a certain kind of democracy, and worse than that, they are possibly sundering the basic consensus of South Korean society by increasing criticism of the role of big business in South Korea and the role of the military. And obviously both the military and the large corporations of South Korea have played a vital role in this continued, I think, stability and economic viability of South Korea. So until they're able to reconcile these kinds of differences, I greatly fear the continued and growth of turmoil in South Korea, which obviously will spill over and have an effect upon the United States' role in that particular part of the world. Thank you.